This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I do have to come in tomorrow for a few minutes. There is a new administrator in the department that I did the big business process investigation for. And so since he's new, he was interested in getting a review of everything that I had done in his absence, and so I'm going to go in for a little bit and chat with him about the program that we had conducted and what had been discovered, and maybe show him some of the books, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I am moving forward, obviously, tomorrow on other things. Not as fast as I had hoped. We were supposed to shoot plastic on Monday, and the injection molder, I called him, and he said that they hadn't been able to get it finished up, that I should call back on Tuesday night and see if they could shoot Wednesday. And so I called Tuesday night, and he said, well, we're not going to be ready in the morning, but we will get it finished tomorrow. So I went down last night, and we actually did attempt to shoot some plastic. It's really interesting. I guess I just always assumed that this was easy, but in fact, there's an art to this, because depending on the size and shape of the mold and all that kind of stuff, there's a fair bit of experimentation that goes on until they get everything calibrated correctly. And so they started doing that. They got the mold loaded. First of all, the mold itself, with all the steel and everything in it, is 800 pounds. So obviously there's not just a couple of guys that are hefting that one up. They actually used a forklift to get it up and over and loaded into the injection molding machine. And then they were good enough with that forklift that they were able to get it up and over and in position just using the forklifts, and then they could bolt it in. I mean, it was pretty impressive. So they got it bolted in. I'm watching, there's a school bus that says Boys and Girls Club on the side of it, and it's got its blinkers going, and I didn't know if I was supposed to stop or not. I'm past it now, so hopefully... Anyways, they got the mold up and over and into the machine, and they got it bolted in, got it in, everything was great. The mold fit together like it was supposed to, and that all looked good. And so they shot their first one, and it only filled up the mold about a quarter. So they said, well, we'll crank it up a little more, and so they cranked it up more, and they got it up to about a half. And then they got it up to about 3/4, and then they got it up to about 7/8, and this whole time, you know, they're just tweaking their settings and trying to figure out how much plastic is supposed to get in, how hot it's supposed to be, when the cold water is supposed to, you know, how long is it supposed to sit. They're tweaking all the settings and that kind of stuff. And apparently, the last time they shot it, they did get it full, but I don't know if they overfilled it or they left it sitting for too long and the thing bound up in the mold and they couldn't get it ejected. So that was last night. Oh, it was about 5:30 or so. And so they were going to have to take the mold out of the machine, get the parts out of it. And they were hoping today maybe to try it again, but they still had some texturing to do on it. And so they went ahead and got the texturing finished up, and now they're closed tomorrow, so we won't be back in to shoot until Monday. So we are a week down at this point, which isn't entirely terrible, because if things are work out well on Monday, they can start shooting product on Tuesday. I could theoretically get some product over, or they could start shooting product on Monday, actually. I could get some product perhaps over to Springfield Workshop, and they could start putting them together, although I'm getting a bit concerned now about the mirrors, because I've had in a 100 set mirror order for about 4 weeks now. And first it was, well, we needed a new blade, and we got the blade in. And now when I call, they're saying, well, we don't have the material yet, but the material should be in soon. And I was talking to the salesperson. The salesperson said, oh, no, we got plenty of material. So I don't know exactly what's going on. I've got to get that nailed down tomorrow and maybe even drop by and see them and say, so, how we doing? You know, got to go in and just kind of talk to that situation a little bit and see how we're doing. Anyway, so things are progressing along with the vein work stand. I do have the website pretty well squared away. I still have some videos to do, and I was actually hoping that I would have product that I could work with over this weekend to start doing some of the videos, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. I do have some of the samples at home, and I have checked them out, and everything seems to be working fine there. So, we're good up to that point, but these are the things that you get into with production, which is the reason that products miss deadlines when they're coming out. Even the great and mighty Apple has missed deadlines, so I have just quit talking about a deadline on the website altogether. Theoretically, it would be possible for me to launch like December 1st if everything falls into place, but if we have a mirror problem, then that may push it later even still. So it's very exciting, but you know what? Everything is fine. It's just all going to be fine. Because at the end of the day, God is in control of all this kind of stuff. He knows what's going on. I have the capability to make decisions and move forward. And the way I've moved forward with this, I'm not really in any big financial hurt. So that's good. Anyways, and the other reason that I'm not really nervous and about all of this is actually because of the topic we're going to talk about today. And it's sort of a follow-on, to something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago in this idea of what is reality and what lies will you believe about reality. And I am still reading the book on creativity. Well, actually, I should say I still have the book on creativity, and it is on my list to read, but things have been busy enough and scattered enough this last couple of weeks that I haven't even read much on it. And so while I do want to get back and do a couple of more podcasts on that, it's not going to be this week. By the way, this is episode 86. We're going to be at episode 100 before you know it. So who knows? We may do a special something for episode 100. Although that's going to be really close to the two-year episode, which is episode 104. So, I don't know. We'll see. Doesn't seem like 14 weeks could possibly get us into May, but actually, I guess it will. We're at that point of the year. So, anyways, today, I'd like to talk about a program that I saw on Oprah, which was really fascinating. Sad, in a way, but nonetheless fascinating. And that is, Oprah did a show a couple of weeks ago with Tyler Perry, who he came out and talked about the abuse that he suffered as a child. And then Oprah decided to do another show where they filled the audience. They had 200 men in the audience who had been sexually abused as children. And, you know, you think about the logistics of this. First of all, how do you find these 200 guys? You put out an appeal, and then you have to screen through the calls, and then you have to get them, plane fare and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's really, the logistics is just amazing. But they have the manpower at Oprah, so, you know, it's pretty interesting. So they had brought in these 200 men that had been sexually abused, and they had done at least one show, possibly two shows. Maybe they taped two shows with them. And I was watching the second one. I don't really know for sure. But it was very, very interesting. Like I said, sad, but very, very interesting. And frankly, kind of an eye-opener as to the number of men that there are, apparently, who have been sexually abused as children. Even Oprah on the show talked about the fact that we're used to thinking about women being abused, but the idea of men being abused as well as children was something that wasn't always talked about. And to hear these men tell their stories and to see the obvious anguish that they're in, of course, was very sad. And they had a psychologist on there who worked with men who had abuse in their past, sexual abuse in their past. And I thought he had a lot of, obviously, really good things to say about learning to mourn what has happened to you and then moving past it and getting professional help and all of those things. One of the things that was interesting to me about that whole program was the orientation of the men describing their experience, describing the aftermath of their experience, and assigning responsibility in the aftermath of their experience. And I was chatting with my wife later about it, and honestly, it is a difficult understanding to come to. But at least in my mind, what has really happened in these situations is that you have had an adult who has given into their flesh, obviously, and has decided of their free will, made a decision. Even though they might want to say, oh, I just can't help it, it's the way I am, they have nonetheless chosen to sexually abuse a child, which, of course, is a very destructive act. And the child who has experienced this, of course, has experienced a very invasive and terrible thing. But these men then carry this for years and years and years and years and decades and decades. And there was testimony on this program that even those who might tell their wives that they had been abused as a child oftentimes would say, but I don't want to talk about it. Now, what's interesting about this is in the men talking about their situations would often say, that person who abused me robbed me of the father that I could have been. That person who abused me made my life what it is today. And so the assigning of responsibility for their state today is always pushed back to that abuser. And yet that abuser has not been in their life for years and years and years and decades and decades and decades. So how is it that an act that was done to them, albeit a terrible, spiteful, destructive act, how is it that this act that was done to them could, all these years later, still have this power to humiliate and disgrace and shame them? When it happened to them as a child who did nothing to deserve it or earn it, not that you ever could, how is it that it still has power over them? And I would suggest that the reason that it still has power over them is because the flesh realizes that it was a terrible act, and it's just using it to pound them over the head, and to continually pound them over to the head and debilitate them, and to tell them a lie about what the world is really like, and to lie to them that the person that is truly responsible for the state of their life as it is in their 40s and their 50s, is that person way back there? When, in fact, the truth is, the person who is responsible for their lives is them. They are individually responsible for their lives. And yes, that's a terrible thing to be done to them. And yes, they may need to seek professional help and to have someone guide them through the healing process, because the flesh is so empowered in their life and has so entangled itself with that situation that it has gained a great deal of power over their lives. But at the end of the day, they are still free moral agents, and they are choosing. They are choosing not to disclose it. They are choosing not to seek help for it. They are choosing to feel powerless in the face of what was done to them. And it gets us back to that Buddhist saying that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. I think it's Buddhist. It may be an author. I'd have to look it up again. I didn't look it up for this. Because there's powerful truth in that statement, that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And while I'm sure it would be a difficult truth for these men to hear, and few perhaps could accept it because they have spent so many years focusing on the abuser as the culprit in their situation, it is nonetheless true that the true culprit in their situation, the one that has donated the most to the situation that they find themselves in after all these years, is not that culprit, but what they have allowed the flesh to do in their lives. The decisions they have made to listen to the flesh tell them something about that event that was not true. That they were responsible in some way. That this event was going to turn them into a homosexual if they were abused by a man. That they should feel ashamed and disgraced, that they can never be whole again, that they can never feel safe again. All these things that are being fed into their spirit, being fed into their minds by the flesh. It really comes back to a decision to listen to that lie and believe that lie that has caused their situation. And I was thinking about that this week. And please understand, I'm not pointing fingers or accusing or all those things. I'm simply trying to speak what is true. And maybe someone who eventually at some point listens to this may have a chance to evaluate their situation and may seek professional help if they are in a situation where they cannot seem to get past an event in their life and it continually causes them to suffer. As I was thinking about all of that, I happened to wander up yesterday, because after we shot the mold, it was Wednesday, so it was fast day for me, and I had pretty much done everything I could do until I get the plastic. I have another marketing thing that I need to do, but I don't want to do it until I have plastic in hand so that I know I can say we will be out in a week, as opposed to, well, we're still trying to tweak the mold, because then if another week goes by and another week goes by and another, then that's bad. And I'm not going to start pushing and doing any more marketing until I have in hand the results from the mold. They actually pop out of the mold correctly. They're actually whole. We've got all the numbers dialed in, and we can produce as many as the machine can produce in a good given day. I'm getting my mail. So I'm on hold with the marketing effort, and I'm really, really hoping that next week, we're going on Monday to be able to shoot this thing and get it out of the mold so that I can then start making plans and have the injection molder start shooting them. And then hopefully get the mirrors together and make sure that the mirrors are on order and they're going to be able to be created and they're over at Springfield Workshop and everything's getting put together and everything's fine, and perhaps even take possession of my first set before I actually start talking to anyone about, okay, this is our release date, which I hope will be December 1st. But anyway, so I had wandered up. I had actually kind of run out of things to do, and occasionally that happens at home. I'm backing into my garage, not very often, but occasionally it happens. So I happened to wander up, and I plopped down on the couch just as my wife was starting to watch another Oprah episode. And the other Oprah episode was about someone called John of God, who is down in South America somewhere, that he's a healer. And it was very interesting. There had been some skeptics that had gone down and looked. One of the producers for Oprah had gone down. Editor-in-chief for her magazine had gone down and visited the place where this man performs his healings. And it was very interesting. It was very, very interesting. But both of them talked about the fact that having been there, they felt like they had experienced something they had never experienced before. And the editor-in-chief, her father had died a year before. And as she was going down there, she was relating how she was still sad over that, and it was like she couldn't get past that and the sorrow of that, of her father dying. And she went down and met with John of God, and she was expecting some big thing, and he just told her, go sit in the meditation room. The first time she met him, he just kind of shook her hand and said, okay. And then the second time, he told her, just go sit in the meditation room for a while. And they had this room where people just go and meditate. And they're supposed to just sit there for hours and meditate. But she said the whole environment was such an environment of people with such faith, believing that something was possible. And she felt such love there and such hope there. And she said she went into the meditation room, and she said she began to meditate, and what seemed like just a few minutes, she realized she had been there for 3 hours, and that in her mind she had had a conversation with her dad, and she was really able to work through all those things. And when she left there, she felt like something had happened. And it was that something had changed within her. She had been exposed to something. And there was a skeptic that had gone down, and he was investigating, and there were things he didn't understand, how John of God could operate on people with a scalpel and dig stuff out of their arm with no anesthetic, and people weren't even flinching, and not really many cases documented of infection afterwards. There's mysterious things in the world. But what was interesting was this doctor, as he was leaving, and they had brought a film crew down to film, and as he was leaving the compound and was talking to maybe the producer or something and trying to describe things and saying, there's some stuff I don't understand there. I don't know how humans can just sit there while he's doing that and not flinch and not feel pain. And so there were some real mysteries. And all of a sudden, he spontaneously started bleeding from what appeared to be an incision in his chest. And that really flummoxed him. I mean, he to this day, he said, I don't know what happened. And he said, it's really changed my whole view of the world, that there are things that I don't understand. He said, I'd gone to seminary, I'd gone to medical school, I'd studied, he's a practicing psychiatrist, I believe. And he was just saying that experience down there just changed what he thought about the world and how he thought about the world. And he said, I still haven't figured it all out. He said, I'm very interested in understanding more of the dynamic of what's actually going on down there. But in the process of all that, Oprah actually read a couple of things that he had written in his book. And I remember thinking when Oprah had read them that, you know, this may not be that far off. I mean, this is a man who's trying to make sense of his new worldview. And I thought there were a lot of elements here in this that really connected with a lot of what I believe. Because in the last couple of weeks, of course, I've talked about the fact that you can believe the lies that the flesh tells you, that the world is a place you should be concerned about, that you need to worry, that you need to be fearful, that things are out of control, that there is chaos. That you can believe the lies that the flesh tells you, or you can believe the truth. And that is that God is intimately connected with this creation, that he is holding it together by the power of his will, and that he is reconciled to mankind, and he no longer counts men's sins against them because of the sacrifice of Christ. And I can just hear some of listeners saying, but, what about this? What about that? Okay, but, I leave to God all of the minutiae about where a person stands with God. And I rely on one thing, an understanding that he has reconciled the world to himself, that he is speaking to everyone all the time, that he loves people very much, and they are very, very precious in his sight. So with that as a backdrop, listen to what Oprah quoted from this doctor who had had this experience that he could not comprehend. This is what the doctor said. My interpretation of what happened to me is this. In short, we all matter far more than we typically have a clue about, and love is what's real. We tend to believe in what we can see and touch and believe that the world is as it appears to be, and that the world as it appears to be is the real world. On the basis of my experience, I have come to believe that reality is both revealed and concealed by the world that we see with our eyes, and that none of us are who we appear to be. Okay, well, there's some interesting points in that. I mean, I absolutely agree with him that the world is not what we perceive it to be when we believe the lies that our flesh tells us. And that's why I'm not really concerned that much about the fact that I've been delayed with the vein work stand, because it's all going to work out. It's all going to be fine. It's all just part of the adventure where I am learning that despite the fact that I want something, it is better and higher for me to treat people with kindness and generosity. Certainly not to be undiligent about trying to move the project forward, but I'm not going to yell and holler because they are loved of God and they are precious in his sight, and it is through his power that they even exist. So I'm not going to demean or diminish anything of his creation that he loves so passionately. Now, here's something else that she read a second passage, and she actually ended her show with this. And I thought, well, that it's something to think about. That's pretty interesting. So I just pass it along because it's sort of in this vein as well. This is, again, the doctor writing. Perhaps the real heart within us is not just a pump. Perhaps the real heart within us is about love and faith. Perhaps the real physical body is not who we really are. Perhaps we are these invisible souls walking around, and the body is just an instrument or metaphor for something we are trying to learn. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.